And now, the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
Big D and Bubba, they have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind, so they have an extra one, and that's how we get the podcast, the podcast, the podcast. Big D and Bubba podcast.
I looked over at Bill smiling.
Big D and Bubba podcast.
All right, before we dive into exactly what just happened here, I do want to say that we're coming to you from the O'Reilly Auto Parts studio. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. And if you are an artist or a content creator, a Twitch gamer, or maybe you're like Patrick and you sing podcast intros,
that's right.
Pickle Jar is going to help make you more money. You can keep 100% of every fan tip, song request, or crowdfunding donation to support your creative talents or that. Plus, you can claim your sign-on bonus of up to $350 when you create your account. Download right now at picklejar.com or wherever you get your apps.
Our guest is Bill Cody, born in 1846, American soldier, bison hunter.
Are you looking on another
Bill?
Yeah, Buffalo
Wikipedia?
Bill Cody, yeah. Not the same guy.
Bill Cody, of course, one of the most recognizable names and voices in radio, and you do everything, TV and films.
It's a guy who's seen tons and bazillions, pretty much every artist you can think of, play in front of him for their first most nerve-wracking time ever. Bill, have you heard anything more impressive than Patrick's podcast intro?
Well, is that him doing the voiceover at the very beginning as well?
The robot?
No, the robot is not me.
That's Stephen Hawking. That's
I not only sang that song, I wrote it. I know you're shocked because it was really...
Well, I could see the passion as you sang it. So I knew there was some sort of insider trading going on.
Yes.
Yeah. I love Bill's been, 45 years you've been doing this? Or longer?
51.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I started when I was 12, and I turned 63 in December.
Well, congratulations. So, that's cool.
Yeah. And I've been at WSM as we do this. I'm just shy of 28 years.
So when WSM AM 650 is such an iconic radio station.
Well, it's a radio station from Coal Miner's Daughter. Right, wasn't it?
I don't think that's not where they're supposed to be driving to, right? It's not the studio. It's like the building next to the tower transmitter.
Yeah.
But I learned talking to Bill the other day that the radio station was never broadcast from that building.
Yeah, it was strictly the transmitters, and we had engineers 24 hours a day who literally lived out
Think
there.
Think about that. As long as we've been in radio, has there ever been an engineer who lived at the thing 24 hours a day?
So you're talking about the one off the interstate where the tower, it looks like a house at the bottom.
Yeah, there is a house there, and if you walked in, you've kind of stepped back. Well, they renovated it somewhere along the way, but... The kitchen is like stepping onto a movie set from a 60s sitcom.
It's got
like
all the colors.
Leave It to Beaver. You walk in and it's like, whoa.
Everything's made of Bakelite.
But the artists would come out. When the flood happened in 2010, we were displaced from the Opryland Hotel because it flooded. The only place it didn't get wet at Opryland was our studio. But otherwise, the hotel was shut down, and so we had to leave. So we created a makeshift studio in Brentwood. That's I-65 for people who've been through Nashville, and they look over and they see this diamond shape.
Yeah, it's a very unique tower. And, like, there's only like a couple of those in the whole entire world.
Yeah, Blaunox was the company, this German company that made that tower. And so that's the transmitter location, and it was never a studio. But artists came out during the 2010 flood and then our subsequent movement out there we came back in December, and they were like, oh, this is where I auditioned. And they had all these revisionist history stories, and
so they believed that they had been to that building, and they never had,
because it was so reminiscent of national life and what it looked like inside there down at 7th and Union, which is where TPAC is now, that when they walked in and they could see the big shield and the call letters in the floor and We Shield Millions and WSM and everything about it kind of took them back. And so you just kind of stood there and nodded and smiled.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, that
oh,
didn't
yeah,
happen
right.
here.
Sure.
Wow. Yeah.
When did they build the fishbowl?
What is the fishbowl?
That's the studio you're in now.
Yeah, the Opryland Hotel Studio, the Magnolia Lobby Studio. It preceded me by a long time. They brought Charlie Douglas in from New Orleans, at WWL in New Orleans.
Yeah.
If you remember when Charlie was doing the all-night trucker thing.
And I do, actually.
Bud Wendell, who was in charge in those days with Gaylord Entertainment, mm-hmm. and of course National Life had owned the company prior, and there was a short time with American General, and then the Gaylord family came in. And Bud, who had started as a penny policy salesman with National Life and Accident, had worked his way up to managing the Grand Ole Opry and then eventually running the whole company.
Yeah, and now he's in the Country Music Hall of Fame.
And you know who he went in with? Elvis.
What? Good class, bud.
Wow.
It was Elvis, George Morgan, and I think Tammy Wynette and Bud.
Yeah. Y'all, I mean, you're going to have to, if you're watching or listening to the podcast right now, you're going to need to, you're going to have to open up your brain for a little bit, because you're getting such a behind the scenes look at not just radio, not just country music, but the legends and the wrong information, the misinformation. Like, I really thought that old building was the coal miner's daughter thing.
Well, I tell you what it was most famously used for recently that people would know, and that's Chris Young's video. For Raised on Country.
Yeah. Raised on Country. He shot it there?
He shot it. That he is right there in the transmitter room.
Oh, that's so cool.
Where it says, danger, do not enter.
Yes.
They took those signs down from the video shoot.
What you're thinking of is there's a shot in Coal Miner's Daughter where they pull up to that building.
Okay.
Like they're supposed to be going. But actually, no, I think that's the WLAC old transmitter building.
Look,
that they pull up
it's to. Been a long time since I saw the movie, but in my head, I always thought it was that old building by the transmitter and all that.
Mm. Yeah, but it's not. They were just using that for a prop. That wasn't where the studio actually was.
Can I tell you, because you mentioned Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yeah.
This is the 40th anniversary year. 42nd. Let's see. This is 2022. It came out in 1980. 42nd year for Coal Miner's Daughter.
Wow.
My wife and I, we got married on February the 29th, 1980. February the 29th. Yes. Every 4 years. We honeymooned.
Got that.
Honeymooned in Nashville. Went to the Grand Ole Opry for the first time. That night on the bill promoting their forthcoming movie, like 2 weeks later, Loretta Lynn was on the show and brought out Sissy Spacek, who would win an Academy Award for portraying her.
And
so that was our first visit to the Grand Ole Opry.
And that's a surprisingly, she's a great singer. Like, I was blown away that, she was doing all the voices and all that.
You remember, of course, Tommy Lee Jones famously was Dooley.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That was your first time at the Opry?
First time.
Wow. Did you have a moment there that night where you were like, I want to work here one day?
I had already dreamed that.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I was watching everybody like a hawk. The only person from the golden age, if you will, that wasn't there was Ernest Tubb, and he was snowed in Amarillo, and he didn't make it. And what's crazy about that, talk about destiny, is we brought our young son to Opryland 3 or 4 years later, and Ernest Tubb's funeral was going on across the street at what was then Two Rivers Baptist Church on our first Opryland visit with our son.
Wow.
There's so many connections.
Yeah,
it's
crazy. I was going to say, you're always tied to these major events.
And some way.
You know, one of the craziest ones, we were here, we came back another time, and it's when Barbara Mandrell had that terrible car accident that changed her life and career, ended her career, basically.
I don't remember. What?
And she had a head-on collision, and the other driver was killed, and she suffered head trauma that she's dealt with even to this day.
I always wondered what happened to Barbara Mandrell, because she was so huge. And then
they had the variety shows, the sisters. I mean, it was everywhere.
Yeah. But we were in town when that happened, and it was like, stop the presses. Everybody went live and was covering it, and they were at the emergency room at the hospital and trying to figure out what was going on. And
well, she was a big star.
Oh.
And yeah, Patrick's
she's
right.
She's the first person to win the CMA Entertainer of the Year twice.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She won twice in a row.
I remember listening to WSM when you guys were – I always remember when George Jones died and you're covering, you guys were covering the procession, the funeral, all of it.
Oh, yeah, the funeral service.
Mm-hmm. The service. And it seemed like all of Nashville was listening and had everyone on. I would pull up to a red light and I could hear, you know, you can hear when someone else next to you has it on, and you could hear it through the in the window down. I always think how great and what an honor that was, and it was just so cool. That's what I love about that the radio station, is that it. And I listen all the time. I love to go out in the back and have a fire and listen to the Opry. It's one of my favorite things to do. Sit back and just listen to it right on the
you're hearing
radio.
You're hearing those moments that people are going to be talking about decades from now.
Yeah,
I'll tell you how the George Jones news broke. I got a phone call from a friend in the medical business. He's in the hospital industry, who no longer lives here, but was very close with George and Nancy. And I got a text, and it said, this is not for broadcast. I'm in the middle of the show. Jim Ed Brown is in the studio that morning.
I loved him too.
And he said, George Jones has passed away, but you cannot say anything about this. I just wanted you to know. Well, I'm sitting there with that in, you know,
that information
running through my mind, looking at Jim Ed going, oh my gosh, the decades they have spent together as family members of the Grand Ole Opry. And I can't say anything. Well, guess who's coming up next following Jim Ed? Mark Chestnut.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Who is the next generation George Jones, right?
Yeah.
And so influenced and encouraged.
I mean, they're both from Beaumont. You got all the different ties together, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. So by the time Mark gets there, Jim Ed leaves, and I don't believe I was able to tell him before he left, and then the news started coming in, you know, just more and more phone calls, social media, even though it wasn't as prevalent then as it is now. And Mark came in, and he sat down, and he knew. And we talked about it, and he was just so emotionally distraught. And we were in the break getting ready to go live for the first segment, and he just broke down. He said, I cannot do this. Mm. I'm going to have to ask you to give me a mulligan, and I'll come back. I said, absolutely. And he literally just, when he said goodbye, he just broke down in my arms, and he cried. And that's what I remember about learning about his passing. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you mentioned the funeral service and the radio and television coverage, national coverage.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
You asked a question earlier about that studio, Fishbowl Studio, and I didn't finish. Bud Wendell brought Charlie Douglas in from New Orleans to start something called the Music Country Radio Network.
Right.
And if you look at that studio, it's outside that Magnolia Courtyard and then faces the lobby. That was still the outside. That was a part of the porch.
Oh, that was the...
Those archways, if you see in the studio, there's a facade there now for the radio and television studio and our set for TV on Circle Television. But that was enclosed. That part of the porch was enclosed along with... It adjoined a hotel room, and they built that studio, I want to say early 80s, early to middle 80s. Because
so that used to be where the hotel ended.
Yeah.
And so it was on the corner. So people could walk by still, but they were at basically the entrance.
Yeah, they just didn't close that part to make that studio.
Because now, if you've never been, it's like in the middle of a hallway. Like you're going down the hallway, and then you go, oh, look, there's people on the radio.
But if you go outside to the courtyard and you look at the porch, if you will, as you stand there and look, and you look to your left, it goes down a ways. But if you look to your right, that's where our studio is, and you can see that, oh, I get it now, the architecture.
I remember when there was a studio at Opryland. There was an SM studio at Opryland.
Like the theme park.
Yep. And I never understood if, was that part-time? They did it every once in a while?
Yeah, yeah. And if you remember, of course, we had multiple locations we could broadcast from, but it was in that, it was also used as a kind of a karaoke recording studio where you could go in and sing along and
hear your own
cut
voice
yourself
on record.
A record.
Oh, cut yourself a 45.
Like those little mall kiosks.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Wow. And it was next to that record shop that was in the park.
Yeah.
And near the entrance, one of the turnstiles where you'd go in, where Acuff famously used to say, you can let them in free, but charge them dearly for the food.
Chuck
Morgan, who has recently been recognized by Major League Baseball for, I forgot how many games are in his streak now as the public address guy and the game night coordinator for the Texas Rangers. Chuck was the first nighttime guy I remember on the Music Country Radio Network. And they offered 24-hour, you could be an affiliate and pick up their broadcasting, their different shows, depending on what your needs were as a local affiliate. But Chuck did the overnight show. He was kind of that next Ralph Emery, if you will, stepped into that slot.
You mentioned Mr. Roy. You may not know this. I know you know my wife is expecting, but that we've decided to name him Roy, which is was my grandfather's name. But every time I'm at the Opry, there's so many pictures and signs and paintings and stuff of what were. I know he passed in the early 90s. Was that before you got here?
It was before I got here.
I didn't know the story. Oh,
gosh, there's so many stories. The story is that he was buried in his pajamas because he wanted to be buried immediately upon his death. So much so that they called the old Smoky Mountain boys, said, if y'all want to go this funeral, you better get over here because it's happening.
Wow.
And that's the story I've always heard. Well, now we fast forward and Jerry Reed passes away, who was a dear friend to me. And as a matter of fact, Patrick, you and I had lunch recently at Cilantro, which used to be Denison's, and it used to be Sylvan Park, all the same restaurant. And that was one of Jerry Reed's hangs. We would go in there, and that's where we'd had lunch. And you look across, and Eddie Arnold and that whole RCA crew from that era would be sitting there. It was a who's who on any given day.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Reed passes away, and his request was to be buried immediately. And I said, well, Mr. Reed, we don't think we can do that. And in true Jerry Reed, clean as snow fashion, he said, you did it for Roy Acuff. You can do it for me. And they pretty much did, maybe not quite as fast, but within hours.
You know, I loved Jerry Reed for so many things, but the one conversation that we had that stood out was when we were talking about, he had some new music out in the early 2000s that he was putting out, very patriotic stuff because we had just gone to war, you know, and we were talking about it, and I think Big D brought it up. He said, do you have any animosity, you know, towards the new guys and all that kind of stuff? And Jerry's like, no, let me explain why. Because once upon a time, well, I understand, I'm the old guy, you're not going to play my songs on the radio, and if you do, it's not going to be much. But once upon a time, I was that new guy, and there were a bunch of people that gave me hell, and I promised myself I would never be that bitter old man. And, man, it stood out so great because people can go, oh, radio forgot me, and we know people that have done that.
There are a lot of people who...
There is one person, one of my heroes. Like, this is a person that I tried to get Patrick to book for a decade, and this guy would not come on the show because radio forgot me. Screw you. And I'm like, no, we didn't forget. We're trying to get you in.
Yeah. Yeah. We're literally calling you right now.
Right now. Isn't that ironic? You know, and I had that kind of, there were a lot of guys. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to.
Right.
All
exactly.
These guys have passed now.
There's somebody's hero. Thinking of,
I will, Bill. I'll name all of them.
Bring
a lot of guys who get into that attitude, though, of, well, radio won't play my records anymore. Yeah, but I mean, we'll still try to involve you as much as we can. You know, just because you're not going to have a hit record doesn't mean we don't want to pay homage to our heroes.
Well, I will tell you this, and I know he would not mind me using his name because he said it publicly on my show. Larry Wayne Gatlin of the Gatlin Brothers, the most talented and handsome of all the Gatlin Brothers.
Of all the Gatlin.
Self-proclaimed, albeit.
Yes.
He said, you know, man, I went through that bitterness and mad, and we weren't getting our records played anymore. And he said, and then one day, it was as if God gave me this epiphany. It said, hey, big boy, you took somebody's place on the chart when you started out.
Yep.
Somebody who had been getting that airplay, that 3 minutes, was not getting it because the Gatlin brothers were charmed.
The most.
And he said, it helped me so much. He said, I got over it.
Yeah.
I was fine.
Yeah, it's like an instant clarity when you realize that you were that guy.
And they're still touring, still playing the Opry, still hosting Opry Country Classics.
The people who can get to the place in their, the artists who can get to the place in their career where they can accept the fact that I am no longer someone making hit records. I am someone who can go out and perform hit records. You know, I can still go out and play my hit songs and people will show up. And some guys get to that earlier than others. Some guys never get there. There have been some guys who, some great folks who unfortunately passed away before they ever got to the place where they understood it's not about making hit records anymore. It's about going out and being a performer and being someone who could, and
go out, be a provider for your family. Yeah. Don't be angry about it. Be happy that you were blessed in the first place.
You had that career.
Yeah.
Not to name drop Tracy Lawrence, because just because he's my friend and he and I do a show together on WSM on Bill Station.
Yes, you
do. But Tracy talks about how he had a great career. You know, he still has a career. He's still making records, but he's not chasing radio hits anymore. And thank God radio gave him 15 number ones, because he can go out until the day he dies and play those hit records, and people will show up and pay money to see him sing those songs. Listen. You know, because country music, country radio gave him a career.
And what's crazy is Tracy is having some of the best years of his life right now on tour. Like people are fighting each other to get the tickets.
Well, look at Kathy Mattea, Susie Boggess, Lori Morgan, Terry Clark. They're going out individually, then they go out together, they go out as a duo. I mean, they are, and Susie said, hey, I'm making a whole lot more money now than when I was a star.
You know.
there's some insight there that you need to stop and think about. It's like, oh, I get it, because you sign these terrible business deals when you're a baby act, and all you want is that brass ring. You know, you're grabbing, you've worked so hard to get there, and you're there, and you're willing to do anything.
You will sign whatever they put in front of you.
You hear it all the time.
And the bad thing is now they have the 360 deals, which is, I say bad, it's good for the record companies, keeps the music working and all that, but it's not really centered for the artist, because they take a piece of the record companies, and everybody takes a piece of everything now. It used to be it was just the music, and you had the touring, we'll take the music, and
you keep the money from the merch. But you know, those things all put back into the pot so that they can help promote you to make you a star.
Yeah.
You know, so all of that stuff works together.
It's part of the machine.
I don't know how much time we have. I know Bill has graciously showed up, but I definitely want you to tell stories about anything you want about being at the Opry and whatnot. But I have to say that the three of us, Big D and Bub and I, got invited back in 2015 to guest host the Opry.
You sure did.
And that was the first time I ever went backstage. Was that the first time you ever did?
Mine too. Yeah.
Mine too.
Yeah. So we're
standing
there.
And which, by the way, we had to get, before we go on, I have to say this, because you're here, we had to guest host, and you were there.
I know.
And I was a nervous wreck, because I was doing your thing. Yeah. And it's so,
tell us, all right, here's what you're going to do. You're going to get a whole segment. It's just you guys. You get 30 minutes of the Opry. You're going to go out, and you're going to stand behind the podium. And we're like, you mean where Bill's standing, right? That's Bill Cody. And they're like, yeah, Bill's going to hand it to you, and you take over. I'm like, you want us to stand at the podium at the Grand Ole Opry House and host the Grand Ole Opry while Bill Cody stands in the wings and watches us? And one of the guys goes, he's not going to watch you. He's going to go in the back and sit on the couch or something. I'm like, oh, okay, good, fine. All right, good.
Oh, I didn't hear that part. Yeah, I thought he was watching the whole time. And I stumbled at one point. I'm going, Bill's he's going to hold a scorecard up whenever I come off stage. Three.
But that was what, to us, I mean, I don't want to make you feel like you've been there forever, but I don't ever remember. I never went to the Opry before you worked there. Well, I never listened to WSM as an adult until before you worked there.
The beauty of you guys sharing that emotion and that moment is that I feel that after all these years, these decades, I feel that every single time that curtain goes up on a show that I'm hosting, I still have that same feeling that you guys had for the first 10 or 15 seconds. Because think about it. People have come from all over the world. It's a bucket list item. You're the first person they see. You're the first voice they hear. And there's this rush as that curtain goes up because of the design of the Opry House. It just kind of swoops down on you. Because you feel this moment where they're like, oh my gosh, I'm here.
It's
it
happening.
It's starting.
Yeah, real.
Yeah. I'm finally doing what I've always wanted to do. I'm at the Grand Ole Opry.
Yeah, and I'm still doing what I always wanted to do. And it never gets old. I walk up that artist entrance, you know, that canopy that you come in when you park backstage. And when you walk in the building, if you recall, the first thing you see.
Security.
Right before security, picture of Minnie and a picture of Roy that are spotlighted. And I never walk in that building that I don't look up, because I had the pleasure of getting to know them both. Not well. Minnie a little better than Roy, but I met them both. And they just, something about that speaks to me as I walk in. And then get my artist cards to head to the podium, and then, you know, it's on. Backstage is just, it truly is that Opry family that you hear about.
Is it overwhelming to think that you're as much a part of the Opry as they were to the last? I mean, Minnie's been gone for more than 20 years. I mean, you're that person that hosts the Opry the most in the last 20 years.
I got a Minnie Pearl story for you. I sat in Mr. Roy's dressing room, which is dressing room one, door always open. You know that story of whoever gets that dressing room has to leave the door open, because he did.
Yeah.
And I had come from San Antonio to Nashville. I can't remember if it was CRS or probably Fanfare. And they, back in those days in the summer months, the park was open. Opryland USA was open. So they did matinee shows. And I had the opportunity, they had booked many among the celebrity guests that I would interview while I was here that week. So I interviewed her. She was sitting in a chair. There was an empty chair as I walked in the door on the right. Minnie was sitting in the next chair. I walked in and I said, we're scheduled to do an interview. And I introduced myself. So I said, I'm Bill Cody from KKYX in San Antonio. And she said, are you married? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. She said, all the good ones are. And immediately I thought, oh, it's on.
She's
in a mood. And I said, where are you going to do the interview? She said, I don't want to get up from here. And so I sat down in that chair as you walk into Mr. Acuff's dressing room, and that's where we did the interview. Well, two or three days go by. We're flying home to San Antonio. And front page news, Minnie Pearl has suffered a stroke. I don't have any way to prove it, but I believe, because she wasn't in demand for interviews in those days, and we were a classic country station, so it worked perfectly. And I wasn't going to leave town without a Minnie Pearl interview, I can tell you, because she always reminded me of my mama. But I think I was the last person to interview her.
Oh, wow.
I've always thought that was probably the last thing. And, you know, as I look back, she was tired. Remember, she said, I don't want to get up from here. Mm-hmm. She looked tired, but she was on. And Acuff walked in as we were finishing up. We have got to be better out there coming up. We were terrible. And then she just looked at me, you know, because they would do their comedy routines. And she looked at me and said, he treats me awful. So, you know, to be able to come now as a part of that family and continue that tradition, it means the absolute world to me. It really does.
How far does the station reach?
38 states on the terrestrial signal.
Wow.
And
from one tower.
From one.
And it can be more depending on the weather, obviously. But.
Yeah, and plus you get atmospheric skip, so sometimes you might be getting picked up in Glasgow, Scotland or something. Mm. Yeah, it's really cool. We get that sometimes, too, where people say that I'm listening to your radio station. I don't know how because I'm 1,500 miles away or whatever. Yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but there's still something about listening on terrestrial radio.
It's magic.
Late at night.
We say it all the time.
That streaming does not.
There are parts of the desert that I love driving through. That's my favorite thing in the world, by the way, is driving through the desert just because there's nothing else out there.
Yeah.
And there are parts of the desert where you put it on AM and you hit scan or whatever, a little button that just goes through. Seek. And it'll just go through and go through and go through, and it won't pick up anything. I'm like, this is a magic place. Yeah.
And you hear those stations that still, you know, you hear that compression and that reverb that AM radio has. If you're surfing,
it starts to get like this. You got a little reverb, the slapback.
Those 50,000 watt clear channel stations out there, you know.
So. I remember there's nothing like being driving at night and you've got it on an AM station, and you hear boom, 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 the theme song from Art Bell.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle of the night.
Yes.
That was one of my first radio jobs, was running Art Bell.
I used to call into Art Bell.
I would tell
weird stories. It was great.
Call in and make stuff up just to be just to talk to
I was
him.
On a Halloween ghost story episode one time.
Speaking of early radio jobs, first radio jobs, Big D and I just realized that our first radio jobs were spent on the same frequency, but not on the same radio station.
Yeah, 1590.
At 1590, and your station was what?
WATX in Cookeville, Tennessee. The Christian voice of the Cumberland.
Thank you.
I was on 1590 WLBN in Lebanon, Kentucky, which was my first radio job. We told me how long
did
I'd
you
been
say
doing
you were 12?
I was 12.
Really?
I was 12.
How do you get a job in radio?
Well, he sounded like that. At
listen
12.
To him. He started smoking at three.
Because well, it was Kentucky, and I talked like this since I was four.
Because everybody smoked.
He was like a mini man.
Come on, Patrick. It's the Burley Belt.
There you go.
Yeah, baby.
But I remember, like, everybody smoked at the studio. And they would smoke in the studio, like, on air.
There were ashtrays
everywhere.
I don't even know if my kids would know what an ashtray is.
You're right. If there's one thing societally that it blows my mind sometimes, as far as we've come in so many areas, it is that it was so common and prevalent. And now, just a generation or two at the most, it's as if nobody ever smoked in public. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the only thing that you'll see in public is vaping. And again, you don't need an ashtray for that. So it's like a weird thing.
I was watching Andy Griffith, because I love Andy Griffith at night, just sit around on the couch
too,
and watch
it. I dream of Jeannie is mine.
And you see Andy walks out with smoking a cigarette after he just delivered a baby. I forget the episode. Smoking a cigarette.
Delivered or made?
Delivered. Anyway, but yeah. So it's, I don't know. I think the history of country music continues to thrive, and WSM is such, I mean, it's the mouthpiece. It is the station.
Well, you know, we're 96 years, closing in on 97 in October of this year.
Oh,
it'll be 97 years. So
for the Opry?
Already making plans for it. Well,
WSM. I was going to say, they've already got the plans for the 100th going?
Oh, yeah. WSM. Under, you know, using the slogan of the National Life and Accident Insurance Company, We Shield Millions, that's how they came up with the call letters, went on the air October 5th, 1925.
Okay.
So, in pretty short order, Judge Hay, who had been brought in as newspaper man from Chicago to program the radio station, saw this need, because there was a lot of highbrow programming, theater and opera and that sort of thing during the day. And he had the idea to do country music, old-time tunes. And Uncle Jimmy Thompson was the first guy, if you see those pictures of him.
I had always heard that the piano player had gotten sick, and they called in Uncle Jimmy as like a last-minute replacement.
That part I don't know.
Oh.
But Uncle Jimmy,
that's apocryphal or
he
real.
He would
tell
these stories, sit there, tell stories, play these fiddle tunes. And then that was 6 weeks after we came on the air, and then that morphed into the barn dance. And that, in transition from national programming, they had Grand Opera that preceded the Grand Ole Opry, what we know as the Opry, but it was the barn dance. So in making that transition from the network to the stage of the Opry at the top of the hour, Judge Hayes said, well, for the last hour, you've been enjoying Grand Opera, and this is paraphrasing, but now it's the Grand Ole Opry, and it was just
so. That's where the name
like that. Lightning
because I've
in a
always
jar.
Wondered, like, where he why did they say Opry? Yeah.
He ad libbed it into existence.
So he just made up
just
the word,
play on words, off Grand Opera, the national broadcast on the network.
Like I just saw the other day that James Brown played the Opry.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, and like was doing country songs.
Porter Wagoner invited him.
As we do this show. It was yesterday, 1979.
Wow.
That's, I think, how I saw it. I went, James Brown? And he was doing, like, You're Cheating Heart. And
he covered
and
Hank Williams. He did Tennessee Waltz.
I
know
that.
Is there
any audio or video of that anywhere?
I've heard Porter had a tape but I never confirmed that and have never heard it.
So James was James doing, I mean, because maybe you've heard a little hearsay on it or whatever, but was James Brown doing James Brown style or was he doing country style? I'm fascinated by this.
It was kind of James Brown style doing country, as I understand. Trying to, he was respectful.
Bridging the gap.
And Porter loved him, and Porter was the reason he was there. Now, not everybody agreed with Porter that he should be there on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry, as you can imagine. A bunch of them threw a fit.
Well, I'll tell you, man, that is now going to be a quest of mine. I am going to find somewhere, somehow,
please let me know if you
get
it. Please let me know.
I would think like maybe the Country Music Hall of Fame, they have a bunch of archives somewhere.
I wonder when WSM or the Gaylord Company or whoever it was at the time, I wonder when they started, because I know they tape everything now. You know, so I wonder when they started archiving that.
We've got a lot of archival stuff. I think the issue was it wasn't consistent, maybe. Mm-hmm. And the
sometimes we tape it, sometimes we don't.
Or the storage of that sort of thing as the years went on. Because, you know, back in those days, in the old days, you had a librarian on staff.
A staff librarian.
Yeah. When I worked at WHAS in Louisville, I went there in 1979 as this 19-year-old kid. And we had a librarian.
I want a librarian. We need a staff librarian.
For what? I don't know, but we're hiring one. She's going to be here to tell us.
And you would check out your music. You would put together your own playlist for your show, and you would go in, and Mr. Larry, the librarian, would, you know, we had a lot of stuff in studio on cart, but if it was something deep catalog, they had that all in the library. And you would pull that stuff and take it to
the
studio.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
That is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
And I guess that was a standard at those old 50 clears that played music.
Yeah.
And had a variety
somebody had to be the keeper of the music because otherwise people would walk with it.
Because everything had to be on, it was either on vinyl or it was on reel-to-reel tape.
Yeah.
Wow.
I never knew that. Like, that's a whole side of radio that I never even imagined. I never worked with vinyl. I mean, we do it here as a, you know,
it's
for fun.
Thursday.
I had them at my house when I was a kid, but I never worked at a radio station where we actually play music off of turntables.
No kidding.
I did, because I was doing, you know, hip-hop and all that. I used to do mix shows. So I would do, you know, like Saturday night, it was like a dance party kind of thing, and I'd sit there with the turntables and all that. So, yeah, I actually did play records.
I worked with carts, and I worked with reel-to-reels. But I can imagine, like, what it was like before. You know, you just can. You do this long enough, you kind of go, I wonder what it was like back when they had to cue the record up and get it ready. And I can see all that, but I never imagined that, somebody had to keep track of all the records. And it's not that people would steal them. I bet it's more that people would put them in the wrong place. Like, how do you... You know, how do you find them all in time? How do you catalog them? Who's making sure that they're not getting taken care of?
The biggest issue was cue burn, because you had one copy and you every shift played that copy. So queuing it up quick to get it ready to go.
Do you even know what cue burn is?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
If you hit that white noise at the beginning was cue burn, because actually it would eat up the vinyl over time a little bit. And you could on some of them, I mean big hits that you were playing a lot. It would be white on that black vinyl. You could see where that cue burn,
just wore it down.
Diamond tip needle had cut into that vinyl.
I played vinyl.
At the Christian Voice of the Cumberland?
But did you play vinyl with a penny taped to the top of the turntable stylus?
What was that for?
Well, for weight, because if the little thing was broken, they would put a penny on it to make sure it would not jump.
But that's janky.
He is spot on. Absolutely.
We used to use even these old, I worked for one station, we had these old Gates turntables from like the 50s. And dude, it was like you were shifting gears. There was a lever on it. Mm-hmm. And you would go, coo-coo. I mean, it was like...
That's what I started on.
Yeah, to change the speeds.
Wow.
And it was made out of the most solid cast iron, something crazy metal I've ever seen in my life.
I remember
I stood on them and used to spin on it and be like, look, this thing is unbreakable.
not now, Bubba, standing on it. This is like young Bubba. That's at least 150-pound difference between then and now.
But he's right.
It had a 78 gear, too.
Oh, yeah.
Had a 78 and 33 and 45.
A gear. That's right.
Yeah. Gear. That's how you change it.
And the first... I remember changing the 45s on my Fisher Price. It was blue, and you never.
First record I ever played on the air was Wanda Jackson, We'll Sing in the Sunshine. It was a big pop hit for Gail Garnett. Mm-hmm. And Wanda had cut it, and I was playing it off the album my first day on the air because I got a call. I was in Ms. Bryant's chorus class that Frank Kemp, my mentor, was sick and was not going to be able to come in. So I was flying solo, running that big 1950 Gates board, turnpot board. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, the turns instead of sliders.
I had one of those.
Had that, you know, audition channel where you'd cue things up. Yeah. And the mic key, if you will, the on-off switch.
You just flip the toggle
was in the middle,
switch.
Yeah, it was in the middle of the board.
Yep.
And I go in and I cue up and I am all set to go on the country music scene. That's back when every show had a theme, you know, and theirs was Buck Owens and the Buckaroos doing Buckaroo maybe was of course you had those instrumentals that were hits in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You play that and then welcome everybody and fire it off. And I hit Wanda Jackson on 45 instead of 33.
Uh-oh.
The first record I ever played. Well, Wanda Jackson, she's pretty wound up. 33 on 33.
All of a sudden,
yeah. And then you hear, because of the gear shift, you hear, and right into perfect.
Bubba does that now, but he does it on purpose. So people know we have a real record.
Just to prove.
Every
I do
week.
Almost every week I'll do it.
Scratches records.
I'll do it on purpose because, you know, so many people, you know, radio is theater of the mind. So most people fake stuff. Yeah. We talk about the phonies all the time. And our thing is, man, we're having fun. We're doing it the fun way. We're really doing whatever. When I say I'm bringing in cassettes on Tuesday, I bring in cassettes. I mean, we do crazy
vinyl on Thursdays.
Yeah, so I mean, we have fun with it, and it's really cool to you know. I'll mess with the pitch control on the cassette player sometime and go, "Ooh, it's messing up," but it's just me just playing with it.
I got to tell you, one of the things I remember first hearing you guys do was an interview with Charlie Daniels, and that has been years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When you, at least when I first remember you guys on air in Nashville.
Yeah. Yeah, he was our first interview ever as a show. We've been doing this.
Oh, interesting, because he was my first WSM guest, my first day on air.
Really?
They asked me who I wanted, and I was like, I want Charlie.
That was basically what happened with Patrick.
Well, I got the job. I've been here almost 23 years, and they said, try to get Charlie Daniels because he's promoting something. So I tracked down his publicist. Paula Sigas was still his publicist. And I, you know, we were in Baton Rouge, and we had never done celebrity interviews before. Mm-mm. You know,
no.
I'm sure some people had come in, new artists, but never somebody that we were fans of, that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was our first time really getting to interview somebody like that. And all we did was talk to Charlie Daniels. I say all we did. We talked to Charlie Daniels on the phone for like 7 minutes. And then we all cheered and hollered afterwards like it was the greatest thing ever done.
What I remember was in studio. He was in studio with you or in a studio. I just remember because
he had come in several times,
but that first one was, I mean, it really did feel like we won the Super Bowl. We had Charlie Daniels, Daniels on the show.
When we got to Nashville, we asked him to come in and do an interview. It was our first time actually meeting him. Actually, the first time I met him in person was at Fanfare. We were doing interviews. You guys were still in the studio, and I was on site doing the interviews. And he walked up, and he was wearing the biggest. He took his hat off, and when I tell you the hat, the head part of his hat had to be this. I've heard a 10-gallon hat. That was like a 40-gallon hat.
That was a bull rider crease, is what that is.
Just gigantic hat. And he sat it down on the chair next to him. And when he took it off, I thought, oh my God, Charlie Daniels is Santa Claus. He's country music Santa Claus. I had no idea. I never put two and two together. I'm like,
Isn't it interesting how radio and radio shows change with time and age? You know, like, your type of show is not our type of show, but our type of show isn't, you know, maybe someone else's type of show who's younger than us. And I think it all works, and it connects to the audience some way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so, I like listening to you. Because you're just so like full of like little stories. You'll like go, you know, popcorn. You know, I remember I was blah, blah, and you'll come off in some crazy story and tie it all in together. And you kind of almost kind of Paul Harvey it. And that guy's name was Little Jimmy Dickens. Anyway, you may know him as Garth Brooks. It's just fun. And you have us. We're kind of doing this weird hybrid, you know, because we grew up listening to like the zoo formats, you know, of country of morning
of the
shows.
80s and 90s.
Yeah, of yeah. radio shows.
And I grew up with the full service guys, you know, who could do it all.
Yes, yes.
In some markets, Louisville, I mentioned, was one of the markets I was in before. Morning guy did midday weather on the CBS affiliate, which was also owned by the Bingham family in the same building,
mm-hmm.
who just passed away, Wayne Perkey. He was Mr. Morning Louisville Radio
wow.
for decades. But he'd finish the morning show and do some prep for the next day and then walk down the hallway and do noontime weather.
For the TV station, you mean?
For Channel 11,
wow.
the CBS affiliate. And that was going on here. You know, Ralph famously did that
local
television
sure.
on WSMV in Nashville, Ralph Emery.
Ralph, since it hadn't been that long since Ralph passed, did you spend a lot of time working with Ralph?
He was so influential from a distance at first. And then I interviewed him as Nashville Now was coming to an end and Crook and Chase were taking over that slot. You remember on TNN.
Mm-hmm.
He had come to San Antonio to do the last series of shows at the Fiesta Texas theme park, which at that time Gaylord had an interest in, a business interest in. And so I scheduled an interview and went to his hotel room, his suite, and interviewed him. It was my first time to meet him and interview him. And he called me shortly thereafter and said, "Hey, I've got this idea for a television show that I've been mulling around, and I think you're the guy to host it."
Wow.
Just from that one interview. And then we became fast friends after that. So
I saw him, a couple of years ago. He was walking. I think at this time he had someone, like a nurse, like an assistant or something was with him. And he was walking in Kroger shopping, pushing a cart, and he had his Ralph Emery jacket on. It looked like a Letterman jacket with like white sleeves and the black part of the body part of it was black, and it had Ralph Emery on it, and it has Ralph scripted sewn in as uh-huh. his name and all this stuff. And I was like, "Hey, Mr. Emery, how are you?" And he was, and he still sounded exactly
oh yeah
the same that voice.
Yeah,
he was like, "Well, hey there." And that was it. He just kept on going.
"Can you move? I've got to get some of that spaghetti."
I used to listen to my dad. I grew up going to school. My dad would listen to WSM AM and Ralph in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. He did that all night thing into the early morning. And I asked him once, I said, "Did you ever do mornings?" And he said, "No, not unless T. Tommy was late."
So, I did mornings a few times when I was the overnight guy. I remember that.
So what are you doing? What can we promote for you? What you're doing? I know you got a new TV show and all kinds of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, in addition to mornings on WSM, just started a series. It's in its first season called Bill Cody Presents on Circle,
mm-hmm.
which is the new home television home of the Opry and a joint venture with Gray TV and Ryman Hospitality Properties. And had Garth Brooks was
your first guest, right?
Was my premier guest. Yeah.
It's a pretty good way to start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
even after, if you recall, last August, I single handedly shut down the Garth Brooks Stadium tour in Nashville. You remember?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there.
Okay. Anyway, Garth, Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel, they got 50 years under their belt, half 100 years, as Jamie Johnson said. And Ray took that and ran with it. And Pam Tillis, Kathy Mattea, Marty Stewart, and Ronnie Millsap, and Brenda Lee in the first season. So we're already putting together our wish list. Because a lot of it, as you know, guys, is just trying to get their schedule to match your schedule.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of whether you want them or they want to do it. It's just making it happen.
Yeah.
You know, and
how'd you kill the Garth show?
So Garth invited the Opry to open his Nashville Stadium show. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. He had all the stuff up there.
It was Larry Gatlin, Jeannie Seely, Chris Young, Emmylou Harris. So I'm hosting. So I go out, welcome the Garth show, and the Grand Ole Opry. Chris Young comes out and plays.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so it's on, right? Well, what I don't know, and we knew there were storms in the forecast, but it's all going on behind me, north of the city. I'm looking the south end zone, looking south. Have no idea that it's as bad as it is. People who were there said, there was this jagged lightning going on all around you.
And you're just like,
and you were oblivious. Yeah.
If you've ever been to the Opry and seen Bill while somebody's on stage, he's standing there and he's smiling. That big million-dollar smile, and there's probably lightning and hell.
That's
going
exactly what was going on. People send me pictures, still photos. And of course, that stage, you know, it's just the most incredible thing. It's this big octagon.
Yeah.
Monster. And Emmylou sang, and the idea was that Chris would come back out. Oh, and Trisha joined her. Trisha, they duetted on a song, and then they left. And what the audience didn't know is that Chris was coming back out, and he and Garth were going to do Two of a Kind, Working on a Full House.
Oh, wow.
Well, I'm introducing that segment. I'm getting that set up, and all of a sudden, my mic, I started hearing like two-way radio chatter, and I thought, man, that is really loud. Where's this come from? Just enough to be distracting, but you're still staying focused and doing your thing. And then all of a sudden, I could tell my mic was off, and I hear, please make your way to the concourse, and I look up, and there's the emergency on the Jumbotron. The exit procedures because of the thunderstorm that was rolling in, the severe weather. And so we all head off stage trying to be cool. And you know everybody's rolling on this, right? And first guy to meet us at the foot of the stairs was Garth with his hat off and his hand out, thanking us for being there. And he said, go to my dressing room. And we sat around waiting as a part of a rain delay, thinking we would go back out.
Yeah, it was a long time.
It was the most joyous night to sit around with no cameras. There were no recordings going on. And it was Garth and Trisha just hosting us, sitting there on couches. By the way, his dressing room is the Titans locker room.
Nice dressing room, Garth.
But it was just so comfortable. And he still says to this day, he said, that was maybe my favorite moment of my stadium tours, was just sitting around in... You know, he and Emmylou are both in the Country Music Hall of Fame. Larry Gatlin's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Jeannie Seely, of course, still recording, still at the Grand Ole Opry.
Bill Cody's in the Country Radio Hall of Fame.
He's not going to say it, but I'll say it.
Thank you.
Well, you know, Garth, the first time we met him, at least I did, Dee and I had just started doing the show. Garth was playing Baton Rouge, and we were hanging out, and for some reason we ended up backstage, I think because we wanted to go for the photo op or whatever. So we go back there, and it was totally different than everybody else's backstage. It was the same kind of thing. There were sofas all over the place, and he's like, hey, have a seat, you know? And so we sit down, and Garth's like, you want a water? And I'm like, yeah. And I go to get up, and he goes, oh, no, I got it. And he walks over and goes and gets me a water and brings it back, and I'm like, Garth Brooks just got me a water. And that's when you knew, man, he's on a different level than everybody else.
We were sitting in that locker room, dressing room, and I said to him, because it was kind of awkward, because I had really done my thing, and I thought, well, if we're going back out, there's no need for me to go out there. But then again, he may be thinking, hey, we'll just start the whole thing over again. I'm not sure. So I said to him, I leaned over and I said, look, I don't want to be pretentious here, but do you want me to go out if we go back out, if this doesn't get postponed?
Right.
And he said, well, if we're going out, you should go out. And I was like
he's
so... He didn't have to do that.
He is so accommodating. Mm. I've never seen anybody... I mean, Garth wants it done the Garth way, but he wants to fit everybody else into it and let them feel like it's their way.
Well,
it's amazing how he does that.
We had different dressing rooms, obviously, and we were all just glad to go back to our dressing rooms and be safe and wait this thing out. And I heard him yelling, because I'd already passed his dressing room door, and we were headed down to the Opry dressing room door where we had a shared space there. And he was like, no, come back. We turned around and said, what? He said, go to my dressing room. And that's where we spent the rest of the night. And then they finally, you know, they couldn't reschedule it. Thought they had it rescheduled. And the next morning in the wee hours, when I woke up to this text about 5 o'clock, it was like, it's not going to happen. Not now.
Right. I'll top Bubba's story just a little bit. Not top it, but we went to a Garth show.
You're such a dude.
I know. We're telling Garth stories. We were at a show at Country Radio Seminar where they had gotten Bridgestone Arena, which holds 18,000 people for a concert, but they had only put one section, and they only put like 800 people in it. So Garth is playing for like 800 to 1,000 people in an otherwise empty arena, and he's playing acoustic. This is like 4 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. I can't remember if it was 2018. It was 2019. So we're sitting there, and Garth is playing, and he's doing his question and answer thing, and he's letting people ask questions. And someone asked him to play a really slow kind of, you know, emotional song. I can't remember which one it was. And he starts playing it, and right at that moment, we were in the third row. My wife sneezed, and Garth stopped and said, "Bless you." And then he started playing the song again. And I went, "Oh my gosh. You sneezed and Garth Brooks said, 'Bless you.'" Like, that's never going to be.
That's how you know it's a mega intimate thing.
That's a really intimate concert. Also, my wife didn't know who Garth Brooks was when we met. So there's
what?
That.
Well,
oh, no.
Country Radio, yeah. The most recent induction of the Country Radio Hall of Fame, Garth and Trisha showed up and surprised Keith Urban, if you recall. Keith was the Career Achievement Award winner. And Garth and Trisha showed up and did that very thing, that whole intimate thing you're talking about, just him and his guitar, self-deprecating. And
Garth Brooks and Keith Urban. Garth Brooks sang a Keith Urban song.
And
then they both sang like Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah. And Trisha has got such a wicked sense of humor. She is so quick. And when I interviewed him for Bill Cody Presents on Circle, I said something about it. I said, her sense of humor, she is like stand-up comedian fast. And he goes, "You should try to win an argument with her." Like, who you telling?
Man, it's been so fun. Thank you for giving us the time.
Oh, thank you for asking.
It's so great. So many great stories. And you can follow Bill at Bill Cody WSM on Twitter, and I guess you're on Instagram,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Instagram, Facebook, that's the one. Kind of
It's still the same name.
Do you know that if you go to lunch with Patrick, you guys would probably know this better than anybody, at a Mexican food restaurant, he will not let you have chips. He won't order.
I didn't say you couldn't
Wait,
have
what?
Chips.
He won't let you
I
have
asked
chips
if you wanted chips because they don't
eating
bring me.
Chips.
Yeah, they don't
you
bring it to the table. Right.
You're not allowed to eat chips. Yeah. I'm just putting exactly. that out there.
That's the way he is.
In case
that's,
you ever get invited.
Can you imagine?
That is not how that happened.
So if you ever, if you're listening to this podcast and you ever are invited to hang out with Patrick, you have to say, "Are you on a special diet?" So you know what you can or can't have.
Yeah. Bill, Cody, thank you, man. We appreciate it.
Big D, Bubba, thank you. I appreciate it more than you know.
Bubba, what you got for us?
I have the outro theme.
And are you ready for this?
Oh, it's going to be almost as good as the beginning.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Did you write this too?
I sure
did. Wrote it, produced it, and sang it.
Casting director,
that's
I guess.
Right.
Is that the way this
works? He did it all.
Key grip, he was all of that.
All of it.
Yeah, best boy.
This was the podcast, but now it's over. But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio every day. It was the podcast.
Well, gosh, it's like Roger Miller is here.